Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. It's been just over 3 weeks since the Human Rights Act has kicked in for First Nation citizens living on reserve. The Canadian Human Rights Commission has been supporting the AFN's call for more resources. The Walk for Justice is in its fourth and final event. They're raising awareness for missing and murdered Aboriginal women and calling for a national public inquiry into the issue. The Truth and Conciliation Commission has recently wrapped up its northern event. The second national event was held in Manitoba. The National Congress of American Indians is pleased with its joint statement to work with First Nations in Canada to collaborate on energy and mining initiatives in North America. And Maoli people in Hawaii now have state recognition as the only Indigenous people of Hawaii. It's the first step towards federal recognition. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Actor Gordon Tootoosis has passed away. The Vancouver Sun reports the Cree actor died of pneumonia on July 5th. Tootoosis was known for his roles in North of 60, Legends of the Fall, and Disney's Pocahontas. In 2004, he received the Order of Canada for his achievements as a role model for First Nations youth. The former residential school survivor was also involved in politics early on in his career. Tootoosis served as vice chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations and was also a part of the National Indian Brotherhood, which later became the Assembly of First Nations. Tootoosis died at the age of 69 at St. Paul's Hospital in Saskatoon. Walk for Justice is in its fourth and final event right now. Co-founder of Walk for Justice, Gladys Raddick, says walkers kicked off their national walk from Vancouver on June 21st and are expected to arrive in Ottawa in mid-September. The walk is to bring awareness to missing and murdered women in Canada, as well as a call for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. Raddick has advice for community members.
When a woman goes missing, please, in your community, come together, help look for that woman. Don't just say, oh, another woman's missing. Go out and help and search and help those family members because they need you. They're going through a very vulnerable time and they need you. They need your support.
Raddick became an advocate for missing and murdered Aboriginal women after her own niece went missing from the Highway of Tears in 2005. Her co-founder, Bernie Williams, also lost her mother and two sisters to acts of violence in Vancouver's downtown east side. Inuit film company Isuma Igloolik Productions Incorporated has gone bankrupt. Nunatsiak News reports the company's assets are now in the hands of a court-appointed receiver. Court documents reveal Isuma ran out of money at the beginning of this year to pay for things like salaries, insurance, heating fuel, and other expenses. The company owes $1.7 million to a variety of creditors. Isuma's assets are valued at $3.7 million. The company gained fame through its films The Runner, The Journals of Nude Rasmussen, and Before Tomorrow. Union of BC Indian Chiefs have rejected the harmonized sales tax in the province. The organization's HST committee says it requested a study to explore the impacts of the blended tax on First Nations. The province's finance minister has turned down that request. The Chiefs Council has agreed by resolution to reject the HST, plus urge all its First Nations citizens to vote yes on the provincial HST referendum to extinguish the blended tax. After a long delay, the pretrial inquest into the drowning of First Nation teen Reggie Bushy will finally begin in just over a week. The 15-year-old is one of seven First Nation teens that have died in Thunder Bay while attending high school. Wawate News reports he was pulled from the McIntyre River November 1, 2007. Teens in northwestern Ontario attend high school in the city because their home communities do not have high schools. The paper also reports during the two-year inquest delay, two more teens were found drowned in rivers. The purpose of the inquest is to make recommendations so that similar deaths don't happen again. The National Congress of American Indians is pleased with its joint statement with the Assembly of First Nations on Energy and Mining. Jefferson Keel is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. He says they will work towards collaborating on energy and mining initiatives in North America. He says there are many opportunities, but not without challenges.
There are a number of opportunities. There are tremendous potential for oil and gas. The First Nations in Canada are interested in developing a method to get oil and natural gas from Canada into the U.S., but that requires development of a pipeline and some other things in order to get it to a refinery. So there are a number of issues internationally that would have to be overcome. And as well as there are some other potential energy development in terms of wind energy. There may be some partnerships there, as well as mining. You know, the First Nations in Canada have a tremendous amount, a vast amount of resources located in their territories, and they simply need to develop the means to develop those resources in terms of mines, coal, as well as other types of minerals.
The organizations on both sides of the border have also agreed to establish a North American Indigenous Task Force on Energy, as well as create an Indigenous Virtual Institute on Energy and Mining. The joint statement came out of the first International Indigenous Summit on Energy and Mining, which was held in Niagara Falls at the end of June. The Second Chance for Moms is a new program aimed at providing high-risk young mothers with a supportive learning environment. The program at Enoch Cree Nation recently received a cash injection of $1 million from the province of Alberta to be spread over 3 years. It's hoped the program will lead to improved health, increased self-esteem, positive social interactions, and prospects for further education. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has wrapped up its second TRC national event. Justice Murray Sinclair, head of the commission, says the event was very exciting because of the challenging location in northern Manitoba. He says the northern residential school experience is a little different from the southern experience.
We need to remember that the distances in the north are vast, so when a child is taken away from his home and sent to a residential school, it's often at considerable distance. We've had stories of residential school survivors who were sent as far as 3,000 kilometers away to go to school. That has implications for their ability to be able to get home during any breaks or any summer recesses or holidays, or for their parents to be able to come and visit them. Certainly has implications for their ability to communicate with their parents, either by letter or by telephone. And so the loneliness that the survivors are feeling were considerable. In addition to that, the languages are more numerous in the north, and the language differences that much greater. There were also the issues surrounding the mixing of the Inuit and the Dene people in some of the schools, and the fact that some of the schools side by side in the same community were run by different churches, all create a different sense of the school environment for Northerners than was the case in the South.
About 1,000 residential school survivors attended the Northern National event in Northern Manitoba late last month. Akwesasne was the first stop for the newly created National Panel on First Nation and Secondary Education. The panel visited the community June 24th and spoke with youth, educators, and community leaders. Over the coming months, the panel will be holding discussions with First Nations and communities across the country. The panel is also offering anyone else to contribute to the work by making a written submission directly to them. For more information on that, visit their website at firstnationeducation.ca. The panel was created by the Assembly of First Nations and the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development to look into ways to improve education for First Nations. It's been about 3 weeks since First Nations have been brought under the protection of the Human Rights Act. The Human Rights Act prevents discrimination on the grounds of race, religion, or gender. The Human Rights Act didn't include First Nation residents who came under the Indian Act. The clause in the Act was repealed in 2008, but a 3-year transition period was granted for First Nations to get ready for the Act's provisions. But Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo had called on the federal government to ensure there were enough funds to implement the change. David Golub's spokesperson for the Canadian Human Rights Commission says they have supported Atleo's call.
Some communities are going to have to wrestle with what are, you know, the priorities, what's going to take priority in terms of funding. And it's a very, very difficult issue. And of course, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has supported National Chief Atleo's call for increased resources to meet these challenges, because we recognize that the resources aren't there necessarily.
Golub says the Canadian Human Rights Act has the ability to affect positive change, and he points to the child welfare funding inequalities before the tribunal. Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie has signed a Senate bill into law that formally recognizes Maui Native Hawaiians as the only indigenous Aboriginal Maui people of Hawaii. The bill's chief negotiator was Senator Malama Solomon, and lawyer Bruce Kapler was also instrumental in helping create the bill. Kapler says the new law means the Maui will now have state recognition and is the next step in federal recognition.
It's a stepping stone, actually, that'll lead, we hope, to the completion of what's called federal recognition by the Congress of the United States. You may know that there are more than 500 recognized native entities within the boundaries of the United States, and including Alaska. And these entities, these tribes or clans, bands, family groups, pueblo, whatever form they might have, are recognized as allowed under the so-called Indian Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. They are given the opportunity to have a semi-autonomous inherent sovereignty.
And that bill doesn't make all happy, it seems. Kanaka Maoli academic Kaulani Kauani says the bill is a scam built to undercut the restoration of the Hawaiian nation under international law into law. She also says the bill was rammed through without adequate consultation and massive opposition. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Like me, baby, but I'm not the type for me. You've got
That was Inez with Move Slow. It's been about 3 weeks since First Nations have been brought under the protection of the Human Rights Act. The Human Rights Act prevents discrimination on the grounds of race, religion, or gender. Canadian Human Rights Commission spokesperson David Golub will tell us more.
When you talk to people and you say that people living under the Indian Act were not included in Canada's human rights legislation, the Canadian Human Rights Act, when it was first enacted 34 years ago, you get surprise, shock. Lots of people not familiar with the subject are surprised to hear that. But in fact, it's true. When the Canadian Human Rights Act was made law in 1977, the Indian Act was excluded, and everything and everyone governed by the Indian Act was excluded. And this has only been fixed. It's really an injustice that took a long time to fix. There were several attempts, but it was only fixed in 2008 when the government brought in a bill to change that, take out that language from the Canadian Human Rights Act. And as a result of this change, the Canadian Human Rights Act became applicable to the federal government immediately, but First Nations governments were given 3 years to prepare to respond to complaints that might be brought against them by people who feel that they've been discriminated against in their dealings with the government, whether it's, you know, service that's been provided or some other form of interaction.
Okay, and why was the Indian Act excluded in the first place?
Well, it's a long, complicated, boring story, but the fact is that there was a discussion around the time of making some changes to the Indian Act, and it was felt that, okay, well, this would only be a temporary thing. We'll leave it out of the Canadian Human Rights Act, and then we'll fix the Indian Act, and then we'll go and put you know, First Nations people and communities back into the Canadian Human Rights Act. Well, it took them, you know, a good 30 years to get around to doing that. So the Canadian Human Rights Commission, in fact, has been calling for this anomaly to be corrected for many, many years, as has the United Nations. And so it was a change that was long overdue, and we've commended the government for making that change and finally correcting this historic injustice.
And now, how will this benefit First Nations citizens?
Well, it has the potential to benefit First Nations citizens in a number of different ways. For example, to bring discrimination complaints against their own governments in matters affecting their daily lives, whether it has to do with band membership or housing or other services that are provided by their governments. It also, we think more importantly, could have the potential to change, have an impact on living conditions and the availability of resources that could be invested to improve living conditions on many reserves across Canada. And this is because we believe that the federal government is now going to have to answer as to why there are inequalities of funding for certain services, basic services like, for example, housing or education, or in one case that's come before the courts now, child welfare. Why the levels of funding are different or, you know, lesser on reserve than they are off reserve. And so this is something that could have the potential, the Canadian Human Rights Act could have the potential of being an instrument to bring about positive change.
This also comes at a cost to many of the individual band governments who are going to have to handle these complaints. And were there special resources set aside for that within the past 3 years, or are there now? Because National Chief Sean Atleo is saying that First Nations lack the capacity to implement the changes.
That is a very important issue. I mean, some communities are going to have to wrestle with what are, you know, the priorities, what's going to take priority in terms of funding. And it's a very, very difficult, issue. And of course, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has supported National Chief Adleo's call for increased resources to meet these challenges, because we recognize that the resources aren't there necessarily.
That was Canadian Human Rights Commission spokesperson David Golub. Gladys Raddick and her friend Bernie Williams are raising awareness for missing and murdered Aboriginal women one step at a time. The pair founded nonprofit organization Walk for Justice. Currently, a couple of groups have been walking across Canada in the fourth such walk to raise awareness, and Gladys Raddick spoke with Bomsida.
We left Vancouver on June 21st, National Aboriginal Day, from Vancouver to walk to Ottawa to raise awareness about the missing and murdered women. At the present time, today is Wednesday, July 6th. We are in Exon. And we are heading towards Enwistle for the day and working our way towards Edmonton.
Okay, and when are you hoping to arrive in Ottawa?
We will be arriving in Ottawa on September 17th, 2008, and we are holding a rally on Parliament Hill on September 19th, 2008.
Do you mean 2011?
Oh, sorry, yes, 2011, sorry. Yeah.
We have a time machine. So Gladys, how did this walk begin?
I started this journey. My niece went missing from the Highway of Tears in September 2005. And after compiling information and while I was searching for her, I realized that there was many other women that were going missing and being murdered across the country. And it appeared to myself and my co-founder, whom I met shortly after Tamara went missing, Bernie Williams, we started compiling information in a database of over 4,000 missing and murdered women across Canada. My co-founder, Bernie Williams, also lost her mother and two sisters in the downtown east side of Vancouver to acts of violence over the years, and she is a frontline worker in Canada's poorest postal code, Vancouver's downtown east side, and together we went on a mission because we wanted to raise awareness about the far too many missing and murdered women, and we decided that we wanted to be carry a voice for the families to demand accountability on from the governments about what was going on with these women going missing and being murdered. And together we just went on a mission to raise awareness from community to community. We attended the Highway of Tears walk from Prince Rupert to Prince George in 2006, and that's where the template was set on how to organize a walk nationally. And together Bernie and I have been just working really hard for the families. We've met family members across the nation. We've made, you know, and we've tried to create that voice so that we can start bringing more attention to what's been going on with our women. And we feel that there needs to be an awareness campaign to address all the issues around far too many missing and murdered women. There's lots of issues that the government is responsible for putting public safety measures in, and there's a high rates of domestic violence that where nobody's addressing these issues, and we need to bring these issues to the forefront, and basically tell the Prime Minister that us women are to be respected, loved, and valued just as much as anybody else in this country, being murdered women.
So how do you feel awareness has grown in the 3 years that you've been doing this walk, or since 2008?
Well, I think that, as I say, it started out with the two co-founders, myself and Bernie Williams, who were missing a couple of, and had a couple of family members that were murdered, and now we've raised awareness nationally. We have hundreds of family members and tons of people that are now aware in each community that was hit. There's been lots of awareness, and I believe that had Walk for Justice not walked across Canada the first time, even in BC, we have managed to successfully put the idea in there that there is a need for a national public inquiry. And this national public inquiry is what we're going to be pushing for this year, because the one that's happening in Vancouver right now is it's kind of messed up. They've kind of made it into a Wally Opal thing. When Wally Opal, who was the Attorney General at one time, or Solicitor General in BC at one time, said back then that there was no need for a public inquiry, and that that it would have been a waste of money. When we think about public inquiry, we think about accountability and what went wrong, especially with the Robert Picton trial, and that's what this public inquiry in D.C. was supposed to be based on. But now Wally Opal is trying to combine everything, and the Highway of Tears and the rest of the women in D.C., well, we feel that considering the fact that he said that there was no need for this public inquiry and that it was going to cost too much money, now it's he's kind of changed his tune. Now he's getting paid $1,500 a day for this public inquiry. So the only one that's winning on this is the Canadian government and Wally Opal. And we're definitely against that, because we feel that none of our issues are being dealt with, because the majority of the women that are going missing and being murdered are First Nations. So we feel that this is a war against our First Nations women. We also speak for the other, you know, like the other ethnic races and groups, because nobody else is doing that. We're a grassroots organization, and we don't get paid for what we do. We run strictly on donation and volunteer. Every one of our walkers does not get paid for what we're doing. We're doing this because we care about what's happening with our women.
That was Gladys Radek, co-founder of Walk for Justice. If you'd like more information, you can find Walk for Justice on Facebook. That's Walk, the number 4, Justice. Now here's In Spring from Alyssa Pay Isaac.
A shelter of fear and desire. Why I don't know why I just end up crawling when I try to say the simple words, kiss me goodbye. Why I don't know why, always end up crawling when I try. Oh,
and Reconciliation Commission has recently wrapped up its second national event in northern Manitoba. Justice Murray Sinclair heads up the commission, and he says the event was great, and he learned that the northern residential school experience was a little different than the south.
It was a very exciting event for us because it was in a challenging location, being in northern Manitoba with its transportation and accommodation challenges. But at the same time, it was an interesting experience because the northern residential school experience is different. So from our perspective, it was really quite successful. We had a good attendance. Accommodations were to the max, and attendance and participation was full. And we had a good chance for the survivors to experience each other's company once again.
Okay, now you said that the northern residential school experience is different. And what are the differences?
Well, we need to remember that the distances in the north are vast. So when a child is taken away from his home and sent to a residential school, it's often at considerable distance. We've had stories of residential school survivors who were sent as far as 3,000 kilometers away to go to school. That has implications for their ability to be able to get home during any breaks or any summer recesses or holidays, or for their parents to be able to come and visit them. Certainly has implications for their ability to communicate with their parents, either by letter or by telephone. And so the loneliness that the survivors are feeling were considerable. In addition to that, the languages are more numerous in the north, and the language differences that much greater. There are also the issues surrounding the mixing of the Inuit and the Dene people and some of the schools, and the fact that some of the schools side by side in the same community were run by different churches, all created a different sense of the school environment for northerners than was the case in the south.
So there were six people from four different continents who were inducted as honorary witnesses at the event, and what can you tell us about that?
The intent of the honorary witness initiative that we've started is to engage with prominent people to ensure that they have a good flavor for what the survivors are saying and what the commission is about, so that they can become our messengers throughout the world, and at the same time become the keepers of our history. Some of them that we've engaged with are journalists, people who are in the field of art and writing or in the political field. And so we find that by engaging with them that they become our spokespeople, and not ours in the sense of the commission, but ours in the sense of the issues that we're trying to raise. And that allows us to be able to engage with other prominent people around the world as well. The four people that we engaged this time as honorary witnesses come from different experiences, but at the same time they are all connected to the residential school story in some way. Sheila Rogers, of course, is a well-known CBC journalist, a member of the Order of Canada, and her ability to communicate the message is well-known. Rafiq Amiz was the media representatives from the International Center for Transitional Justice, which is an organization that works in the international arena with truth commissions. Francisco Kelly is involved with the United Nations Human Rights Commission. John Demet, who is executive director of the Stolen Children Cultural Rediscovery Program and Initiative in Australia, was one of our witnesses. And in addition to that, we had Chief Ed John, who's now the Canadian or North American representatives of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and Robbie Weissman, who is a Holocaust survivor from the Second World War.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And through these events and through the Honorary Witness Initiative, do you think that you're breaking ground to be able to tell everyone about the truths of residential schools?
Well, I think with each event that the Commission holds, we engage that many more Canadians in the discussion. This one was different from this in the sense that it allowed the Northerners to be able to talk amongst themselves, probably for the first time, about the residential school experience across the North. And I think that was a unique experience. It also, I think, allowed Northerners to appreciate the significant role that they play in the residential school story in Canada, because it showed how their story was different, but at the same time connected to the residential school story elsewhere. And it engaged the northern media, and through the northern media, the southern media as well, in looking at the residential school experience in the north in its unique way.
So you're saying that it could perhaps have been their first, some of these survivors, their first time talking about this, and do you think that's one of the ways that they have benefited from this process and being able to put that out there?
I don't think there's any doubt of that. The survivors who spoke to us both at the national event and during the course of our hearings in the various communities leading up to the national event told us on many occasions that it was the first time that they had ever spoken of their story to anyone publicly about what happened to them in residential schools, or what had gone on, or what they had heard, or what they knew. And that was a good experience. And we found that as each person opened up during the course of a hearing, that others would then be encouraged and feel encouraged to step forward and tell us their story and their perspective of the same issues. And so we found that as we went through the community hearings, in particular in the months of April and May, that more and more people came forward, so that our lists were longer. And then at the same time, the stories became more cohesive and more consistent, and allowed us to get a really good flavor for the Northern experience.
That was Justice Murray Sinclair, head of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The National Congress of American Indians is pleased with its joint statement with the Assembly of First Nations on energy and mining. Jefferson Keel is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. He attended the first ever International Indigenous Energy and Mining Summit. The summit was hosted by the Assembly of First Nations in Niagara Falls late last month. Here's Jefferson Keel, who'll tell us about the work that came out of the summit.
Well, it was an exciting time for the Indigenous peoples, particularly in Canada as well as the U.S. We had an opportunity to visit together about the potential for energy development in Indian country in the U.S. and in Canada. And so we had a really good conference. There were around 800 people there, and they were from all over. There were tribal leaders, citizens. There were some representatives from government and industry all across North America.
So what kind of opportunities are there that would be crossing the border?
Well, there are a number of opportunities. There are tremendous potential for oil and gas. The First Nations in Canada are interested in developing a method to get oil and natural gas from Canada into the U.S., but that requires development of a pipeline and some other things in order to get it to a refinery. So there are a number of issues internationally that would have to be overcome. As well as there are some other potential energy development in terms of wind energy. There may be some partnerships there, as well as mining. The First Nations in Canada have a vast amount of resources located in their territories, and they simply need to develop the means to develop those resources in terms of mines, coal, as well as other types of minerals.
And I also understand in the joint statement that you want to collaborate with the Assembly of First Nations to create an Indigenous Virtual Institute on Energy and Mining. And what can you tell us about that?
Well, now that would be a way for all of us to learn from each other. We talk about building our literacy and education around energy, and then it also exposes the potential, or it allows people to look at mining, especially among those Indigenous people. You know, there are a lot of mines in on both sides of the border, but they're not necessarily owned or operated by Indigenous people. And so we wanted to develop that institute to help those nations who are not necessarily familiar with that to look at how they can engage and then learn more about the opportunities there. And it would allow it to just work together to maybe look at capital improvements, to look at access to capital. You know, a lot of nations may have the potential to develop resources, but they simply lack the capital to do that. And if they don't have access to capital, then that's maybe something that the tribes in the U.S. help with. And so this is an opportunity to just work together to enhance those opportunities.
In Canada, First Nations are, as you well know, are impacted very much by the energy and mining industry, and those impacts are both positive and negative, with deals going either way and some IBAs or impact benefit agreements very secretive. And what does the picture look like on your side of the border?
Well, you know, on our side of the border, we have tribes who have tremendous resources located on tribal lands, but again... tribes lack the resources to develop those. In addition to that, there are so many federal obstacles that we have to overcome in order to allow for a development of those resources on tribal lands. You know, there may be 7 or 8 federal agencies in the U.S. that have to sign off on that or have to agree to the development on tribal lands because of the federal rules and regulations, and so it's a maze that we have to navigate to get there. So there are obstacles on both sides of the border.
Okay, and I just have to ask this because I live in Canada. Did all that red tape get easier to get through with Obama in administration, or it's just the same as before?
Well, I don't know necessarily that it is President Obama, but I know that Senator Dorgan, who was a senator who retired last year, was very instrumental in removing some of those barriers. And we've talked to in our Congress both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat, and I think that President Obama has definitely been a major influence in allowing those things to move forward. He's got people in his administration that have been really willing to work with the tribes and our tribal governments and organizations to try to remove some of those barriers. So to answer your question, yes, he's been very helpful.
That was Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians. Here's Andrew Menard with Peace.
There will be peace in the valley. There will be peace in the valley. There will be peace in the valley for me. There will be love in this family. There will be love in this family. In this family for me, there will be light on this journey. There will be light on this journey. There will be light on this journey for me. But if I want peace in the valley, if I want love in this family, if I want light on this journey, it's up to me. 'Cause I am the peace, I am the love, I am the light I seek.
Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie has signed a Senate bill into law that formally recognizes Maoli, Native Hawaiians, as the only indigenous Aboriginal Maoli people of Hawaii. And lawyer Bruce Kapler was instrumental in helping create that bill.
Today, July 6, 2011, the governor of Hawaii is scheduled to sign Senate Bill 1520, which amongst, well, primarily, is a measure which will enact the recognition of the Native Hawaiian people as the indigenous, the only indigenous and Native people of the state of Hawaii, and also set up or authorize the creation of a five-member Native Hawaiian Role Commission, which will pull together a certified or verified role of Native Hawaiians who can prove their ancestry and are eager to involve themselves in the creation of a Native semi-autonomous sovereign nation of Native Americans in Hawaii.
And how does this benefit the Native Hawaiians there?
It's a stepping stone, actually, that'll lead, we hope, to the completion of what's called federal recognition by the Congress of the United States. You may know that there are more than 500 recognized Native entities within the boundaries of the United States, and including Alaska. And these entities, these tribes or clans, bands, family groups, pueblo, whatever form they might have, are recognized as allowed under the so-called Indian Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. They are given the opportunity to have a semi-autonomous inherent sovereignty. I like to quote, actually, a Canadian jurist, Thomas Berger, actually, I believe is the way he pronounced it, who indicated in his writings that the United States invented this kind of internal sovereignty. Justice Marshall, when he was on the U.S. Supreme Court, recognized the fact that there could be these nations within the nation. And as I say, there are over 500 of these entities that have been recognized. Once they're recognized, they're understood to be really quasi-sovereign, somewhat separated from the United States. And amongst other things, certain programs, of course, can benefit those native groups that are recognized. State recognition has been granted by about 20 states to a little more than 80 Native entities, and so Hawaii joins those other states in creating this recognition, state recognition of the Native Hawaiian people today.
And so in the Hawaiian rights law, is it going to be any different than the rights that the other nations have in the U.S.?
Actually, those state-recognized tribes or entities are a very... The state recognitions vary greatly. They run a spectrum, it's really we're going to be having the same sort of benefits. But as I say, it's hard to pin down exactly. There isn't any really continuity to what state recognition is granted to those other groups. It varies on a wide spectrum of benefits. Federal recognition, on the other hand, is pretty well clarified under United States constitutional law and various, a number of decisions of U.S. courts, including the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, and one more question. Were there consultations conducted with the creation of the law?
It went through the usual legislative process, and actually the... There were actually two bills that were worked together and went through a number of public hearings. But this is really, actually, it's along the way of a long journey, which actually is, you can trace it certainly back to the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani in 1893. So for the past 118 years, Hawaiians have been trying to travel this path towards recognition of themselves as a Native people. So it's just another step in a long, long process. I understand that you may have received an email copy of a chronology that was developed to educate people on today's event that traces that long history.
That was Hawaiian lawyer Bruce Kapeller on the new law giving state recognition to the Maoli people of Hawaii. Meanwhile, the new law doesn't seem to be good news for all. Maoli academic Huilani Kuani says the bill is a scam bill to undercut the restoration of the Hawaiian nation under international law into law. She also says the bill was rammed through without adequate consultation and it also had massive opposition, she says. You're listening to Bomb Sida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomb Sida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Sida.